Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Carlotta. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carlotta.
Hi. And first of all, I guess I ought to thank Andrew for giving me the opportunity to be a speaker at the meeting tonight. I left early from the women's group last week, and I came in, and I heard my friend speak, and I was moved by her gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I was scooting out the door, and here comes Andrew. And I got caught. So I said, well, it was just last month, or, you know, that was what I was running in my head. But I hope it's been over a year. You guys are going to get pretty bored. Anyway, to make a long story short, what I think we ought to do is we should have split this time with me and my husband, because there's two sides to every story. And that's why they have a book called As Bill Sees It and As Lois Remembers. I just want to say, honey, if I stay drunk too long up here, count my drinks. Oh, give me sober. Give me a high sign or something. I used to think that I didn't have to control my drinking because he would. You know, he would say things like, you know, why don't you just, you know, before we go out, why don't you just decide how many drinks you're going to have and then just stick to it. And you tell me to pick a number, and I go, okay, 10. You know? I'd be serious. He'd be like, no, I was thinking more like 3. And I'd be like, 3? We might as well not go out, too. I remember one time I told him, for sure, if he bought a pool table, then we wouldn't have to go to the bars. And we could just stay at home and drink at home and have fun and play pool. But you know, I got that pool table. It wasn't the same. Well, like me in that old pool hall. And I like that. I like them. I told him I liked my drinks store-bought. I didn't like them homemade. Well, I liked them homemade before we got out, but, you know. And I like taking my little stash with me, but I was never a closet alcoholic. And I'm sure he wishes I was. But, and, you know, a lot of people did. But something happened, just like Joe and Charlie say on the tape, you know, when they take that drink, their foot got to tapping and they got to moving. And, you know, that's the way I was. I remember when I was trying my controlled drinking, you know, we all tried that, switching from wine to booze or whatever. And one time I said, I am never going to drink until I'm in my bed and I have my pajamas on. 3 days later, I came home with my pajama top, what I thought was pretty cute when I left. It wasn't so cute when I was trying to sneak in my house so my husband wouldn't hear me and notice I was gone for 3 days. You know, but the sad part to that story is my son answered the door. And I don't know, he was in high school at the time, and I can remember to this day the look in his eye. You know, he looked at me with so much hate and so much anger, and he hated everything I stood for because I had made so many promises about getting sober and not drinking, about, you know, changing my life, going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this time is going to be different, and it never, ever, ever changed because I didn't change. I kept doing the same thing, expecting different results. I thought, this time, somehow, some way, I will control my drinking. And I tried all those tricks. I tried every which way and loose, you know, to control my drinking. And, you know, I couldn't stay sober for my husband. I couldn't stay sober for my children. I couldn't stay sober for jobs, for employers, for, you know, anybody. I couldn't stay sober because basically what Silkworth says, and that is that the alcoholic drinks basically because he liked the effect of alcohol. and that our alcoholic life becomes our only normal one. And pretty soon I couldn't tell truth from false, and I began to believe, you know, my alcoholic life. And when I didn't drink, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, because a day without drinking, like, or a week or a month or whatever, I would be crazy. You know, everybody in my house would, they didn't know what to do, you know, because I was unpredictable, explosive, crazy when I was drinking. And then when I wasn't drinking, I was this, you know, robo-nag or something, you know, I was this crazy woman, and I want to control everything and everybody, and what are you doing, and you can't do nothing right, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I'd come home, and people would want things, like to eat, and and the bills, oh my God, and phone calls, and I'd be going crazy and nuts, and I can remember, you know, like, burning dinner and being out of dish soap and using the sudsy kind and having bubbles everywhere and kids screaming and my husband complaining and I'm like, what do you want? I'm sober! You know? So, you know, we didn't know. That's all. We just didn't know. We didn't have a clue how to live life on life's terms. We didn't know how to be parents and to be married, be a couple. And to be in a partnership. And, you know, we kind of grew up together, actually. That was my drinking buddy over there. Actually, I'll tell you how it started. I started drinking when I was a teenager. And, what happened, I lived in Seattle. My stepdad had just got out of the military. And prior to that, we lived in these little communities where everything looked the same, all the little houses, everything was like same. If you drive to a military base today, you'll see everything on the outside pretty much is just, you know, cookie cutter, you know, it was like blah. And when he retired, we were in Seattle, and I thought, oh my God, there's color. You know, it was like at night, Seattle looked like a big Christmas tree. And I felt like, you know, I hit the big jackpot, like there was one big, you know, like the candy store was open. And I just happened to be going into junior high school. And so, you know, I was at that age where you're pretty impressionable. And so my first impressions were that I wanted to have fun. I thought that, you know, that color looked good, and I wanted all I could get of it. And that's about what I did. I didn't set out to intentionally be an alcoholic. Actually, I worked my way up to it because I started sniffing glue with my brother first. And so everything after that was uphill, you know. And then we learned to drink, and we would, you know, me and my friends, we would get the booze, and we would steal cars and drive around. See, we're the little hoodlums you see hanging outside them bowling alleys and, you know, ripping off cars or however we could come up with money to get some booze. And we would drink that, you know, high-class wine like Thunderbird and all the rot, you know, Mad Dog and White Port. And so I had me some White Port, and then we'd take Kool-Aid, and we would take the Kool-Aid package and just pour it in there. We didn't, like, mix it first. It'd have color, so we'd have our own little colored wine. And we drink that White Port and Kool-Aid, and then, you know, you get purple puke. It'd be like, that was about the time old Jimi Hendrix had that song, Purple Haze. So, we were actually just, having what we thought was fun. And, you know, that was a lot of work. And so, basically, eventually what happened was I decided that, when most of my friends were going on to high school, I became Miss Alcapana in 1969 and dropped out of school. And one good summer, you know, and then I found pills. And, you know, when I was younger, they had put me on Nebutal to help with a sleeping problem, and I liked that. And so then I found out you could get that any old time, you know, so I like Nebutal, Secutal, Tylenol, any old pill at all. And that took me down paths and measures there were no half measures, let's put it that way, and to a lifestyle that I started out looking for, like, glamour. You know, I wanted that glamorous life, and, you know, that never appeared. It never, ever happened. Because, and I know this is AA, and I always hear speakers say that. This is an AA meeting, but. But, uh-oh. This format really isn't working for me. I won't go into my drug-a-log, but I'll tell you this. The big book says that all them guys in there were dope fiends. I don't know what we're talking about. You know, I mean, in Bill's story and in Dr. Paul's, you know, they were taking, they called them highballs or goofballs or some kind of balls, but we call them speedballs today. But anyway, when I was a chronic relapser, I would come to a meeting and people would be like, oh my God. You know, because I would come in and I would, you know, the topic would be gratitude or, you know, happy, joyous and free. And I'd be having this big chip on my shoulder. And don't say no, I'm not happy. And I got problems and I'm angry and da 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 da. And I would, you know, share my feelings. And people didn't like to hear it, but you know that third tradition that said, I would say, well, I belong here because I say I belong here, and I'm an AA because I'm an AA-er. But anyway, I forgot where I was going with that, other than that I used to look up all the reasons why you were wrong, and I was right to be a chronic relapser and have all these excuses for not working the program. You know, and one of them was I could take pills and, you know, come in and not drink. Or I could have, you know, you hear the old two or three sobriety days. Well, I have this date and this program and that date and that program and this date over here. You know, line them up, brother. You know, I don't. You're wasting a lot of time. But, you know. I would come in and I would, you know, have all the reasons why I didn't, you know, I didn't have to do what you did. I wanted what you had, but I didn't want to do what you did to get it. I, you know, I didn't want to change. I didn't want to let go of whatever it was that I had, no matter how much it wasn't working, no matter how much pain it caused, no matter, you know, the destruction and the insanity. It was what I knew. It was comfortable. It was always there. And if I did this, you know, like they say in the 12x12, if I let go of all those character defects, if I changed, if I, you know, gave it all up, then, oh my God, I'd be like the hole in the donut. Nothing, a big nothing. And, you know, when I got up here and before the meeting, a few people prayed with me. And, you know, one of the fears I had was to be known. You know, and I think that something reminded me of when we were in a program a long time ago, and it was like, afraid to be known, we can't know ourselves or any others. So in this program, I learned that I just get to show up, and I get to be me, and I get to learn how to have peace, like Mindy was talking about before the meeting. She said, just have peace. Because the last time I talked to her, I was like a fly on crack. I mean, I was like, da, 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 da. You know, I could do that. I could do that real easy. But anyway, let's get drunk. You know, I mean, in my story, not really. So what happened was I, you know, drugs beat me down. This is where I was before I got off the fly. I was starting to get geared up. But you know, what happened was, in the big book, it says women are gone beyond all recall in a short period of time, and they turn into the real deal. Well, you know what? That happened to me. I can remember going to Harborview Hospital in Seattle, and the staff member that worked there, he said, oh, here comes the Brooklyn burnout. You know, and I was so insulted. I had never been to Brooklyn. But, you know, it stuck with me. You know, why are people calling me burnout? You know, because that's what happens. Potential women alcoholics, they turn into the real deal in a short period of time. And you get there real fast, you know, on other drugs. It just speeds up that process. And I read about that in Bill's story, too. It got him on the rocks. And that's where I landed up. You know, I had shipwreck, baby. But anyway, when I came into port, I met my husband in a drug treatment program. I had about 6 months sober. He had about a year. We thought it was a good idea to get married. Actually, he was in some kind of group confrontation for something, and I thought, oh, he needs me. And we got married in that treatment center. And another reason I wanted to be in the, you know, couples dorm. I was tired of them women dorms, you know. I mean, I was like, we had our own apartment and stuff, and we got to play house. And and then, actually, it was a good thing. We had a couple of years sobriety together. And we did service work at that program. And we, you know, participated in their outpatient, they call it the RAP. And it was like a, you know, like a, kind of like an AA meeting, but we didn't have no traditions. That's why the program isn't in existence today. And, but I did get introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous there. And, what happened was we, with a lot of people that come into the rooms these days, and that's that, we switch addictions. And for me, I went from, you know, from street drugs to drinking. We thought, well, certainly if we've overcome drugs, you know, we can drink. We can drink like normal people. And so the, you know, me and my husband and another couple, Terry, who I followed up here from Seattle, we all practiced drinking together. And if you knew any of us, you'd be laughing too, because that was the worst idea in the world. And, you know, they all thought they could control their drinking because, you know, they were shining the spotlight on me. Wah. I was a blackout drinker from the giddy up and nothing had changed. So when we would drink, you know, I would be the one that always looked bad and they always looked good because they were standing next to a drunk. And I did what drunks do. And, you know, a few of those times, I mean, we would, like, take off for the weekend to go up to Fairbanks, and, you know, I would be wanting to jump out of the car because I didn't want to leave Fairbanks, and, you know, I want to go back to the party, and it's too long a drive without my booze, and da-da-da-da-da. And they would stop the car, and one time they tied me to a tree, and they left and went over to a bar. You know, that wasn't fair. They would have let them in with me, probably. But, and, you know, my husband and I tried drinking and, you know, going out and doing the bar scene, and we'd always get in, I would actually be the one to always get us in trouble. And, you know, it would be like, back then I was looking good too. I was a hot little mama, you know, and I would play on it, and I would be like, you know, going out with hardly any clothes. I'm white, he's black, you know, we sit in the bar, getting a little toasty. I'm like, what are you looking at? You know? And I want my husband to defend my honor. And so the night would end, like, him in a fight and me jumping on some guy's back, you know, and being tossed around, what's that, like, or knocked off or whatever. And, you know, then I would think, well, maybe I ought to try three. And, you know, or we drank at home. It didn't work either because, I would, after we'd drink, I'd want to go. And, of course, he would have the keys. And so he wouldn't let me go. And then I'd need more booze. And it'd start a big old fight. And one time, we started fighting. It was, and a lot. And so, not a lot. I mean, not no knockdown, drag-out kind of fight. We were past all that. No. But we were fighting and it escalated and pretty soon we were the whole arguing thing, you know, it's my house, you get out, it's my house, you, no. And so then eventually, you know, I'm calling the police because in my mind it was domestic violence. He wouldn't let me drink. And, and in the meantime, I had just went off in oblivion somewhere. And the next thing I know, he was working in corrections, and he had those Ziploc handcuffs on my hands, on my legs, had me laying on the bed. I couldn't go anywhere. The cops were coming. I'm screaming. And, you know, the cops get there, and they come in the house, and I'm thinking, all right. And they look at him, they look at me, and they look at him, and they tell him, good job. They left me there to sober up, you know. And that's the not funny part to that story is my kids were there. and my kids were, you know, there a lot. And I remember my younger son kind of looking in the door, and I could clearly remember screaming at him. I hated him because he wouldn't undo those handcuffs. And I saw the terror in his eyes. You know, my other son, earlier I was talking about, I saw the hate and the disgust. But in this child's eyes, I saw that fear and that terror. And, you know, I'd like to say that my drinking stopped then, but it didn't. There was more stories, lots more wreckage. And it took me 30 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to get 3 years. And next year, I'll be coming up on a birthday, and you know, it's time when you kind of celebrate, reflect on the celebration of recovery. And I think about, you know, what it's like today and how far my higher power has brought me from. And, you know, I look in around the rooms and I see miracle after miracle after miracle. And I see what God has done in others' lives too. And, you know, I have so much gratitude that you can't help but fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I got here, I didn't know how to love. My heart was hard. My heart was just ice. And I was broken. I was alone. I was full of fear. It wasn't even fear. It was terror. You know, I had 100 forms of terror. They should change that word too. But, you know, I guess we all had that. I mean, you know, it goes with the lifestyle. But AA taught me how to surrender, I guess. The only way I knew how to do that was I crawled in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, one more bottom. It wasn't any different than any other bottom. As a matter of fact, if I knew it was going to be my last drink, I probably would have, you know, had a little more glamour or something to my last drink. But actually, it was just another drunk. You know, I was on my way to a potluck that day and then to a dentist appointment. And somewhere between that potluck and the dentist appointment, I ended up getting a DWI and going to jail. I got in a hit and run and somebody hit me and I ran. And, first time wasn't nobody in front of me when I got an accident drinking. I was like, oh hell, I'm gone. But, I didn't go far. And, you know, that bottom got me to a place where I was able to go to another level of honesty that I had never gone to in Alcoholics Anonymous before. Because I had been up to that point, and that was 6 months, that last relapse, and doing the deal. I'd been going to meetings. I had a sponsor. I was calling her. I was going to my aftercare for treatment. And, you know, I was going through the motions. You know, I knew the treatment logo, lingo, whatever you call it, and I was just saying what I thought they wanted to hear. And still in my heart of hearts, I think I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous worked for you, but it wouldn't work for me. And I came here hoping for 30 days sobriety. When I heard how it works, I heard that I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. I wasn't at fault. I was just born that way. And, but, you know, it doesn't say that. And that rarely have we seen a person fail. That's what it says, who has thoroughly followed our path. And those who don't are those who will not or cannot or will not give themselves to the simple program. And all that time I thought I was a cannot. Well, actually I was a will not, you know, because I wouldn't work the steps. You know, I would mouth those words because I came in here wanting what you had, and I thought if I just, you know, that's a lot of 30-day coin, folks. I remember one guy, the treasurer at Dry Dock, he told me one time, what are you doing with all these 30-day coins? Are you taking them home to laminate your wet bar with them? You know, and, or he'd say I was breaking the treasury. You know, I'd get real mad, you know, and I'd be like, I put my money in that basket, give me that coin and shut up, you know. The third tradition thing again, you know. You gotta give me that. Da 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 da. But you know, actually, I wasn't like that when I came in this last time. I tell you, alcohol had beat me down to a place of surrender, and I was broken. And I can remember going in the meeting, and all I said was, "Help me." And I said that I was a failure as a mother, as a wife, as a woman, as an employee, even a neighbor, you know, and that alcohol was too big. It was bigger than me. And I couldn't do it. I could not drink. And you know what? Those simple little words, I don't know why, but that's the first time in my life I had sincerely admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And that somehow, someday, some way, I was never going to be able to control my drinking. That it was always going to be the same result. And, you know, it was like a moment in time when my higher power put in my heart that this was my last chance. I didn't have no more turns around the block. I completely ran out of good ideas. I didn't have any conceivable notion that I would ever be able to drink again. And, you know, that's what it took for me. But the scary part of that was that when that happened, I knew that I had, you know, I had my work in front of me, because before I would see you guys when I'd go out and come in and go out and come in, I'd see your lives change. I'd see you right here in meetings, you know, you're dealing with pain and hurt and, you know, or sexual abuse or, you know, divorce. Or I heard one woman who's a friend of mine, her daughter committed suicide and she didn't drink over it. I would see you go through these things in your life and never pick up. But what I saw was that what I was afraid of was that realness, you know, that scared me to death. I thought, oh my God, this is too heavy for me. I just want to get a little card sign or something. You know, I didn't want to sign up for the pain part of it. And then, you know, I started practicing. They would told me my sponsor came up to me and said, I'm your sponsor. You need one. That's it. You make coffee. And so I still make coffee at that group on Thursday night. And, you know, I watched her and I became willing to do the things she suggested. And she started me out and on, actually the step 11, she had me reading page 86, 87 every day. And I thought, what kind of sponsor is this? Starts me out 11 and I ain't even done one yet. Blah, 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 blah. You know, that old rebellion in me, you know. She picked me, that's what I get, you know, and, actually she was teaching me to pray and I didn't even know it. She was teaching me, and I needed it so, so bad at that time. She was teaching me that, how to start my day. I didn't have a clue how to start my day, you know, and, she also had me do steps 1, 2, and 3 every day and, read the big book and work the steps in order. And, you know, I love that 1, 2, and 3 every day. I still do those basic things. My husband and I, most of the time, we pray together. We do steps 1, 2, and 3 together, and we say the third step prayer together. And if we don't, we do it individually. But, you know, because I get to wake up and I get to decide, you know, do I want to live in the problem? Because that's what step 1 was for me, that powerlessness, that unmanageability, that hopelessness, that insanity of, you know, that battle, drink, da-da-da-da, you know, or do I want to come to the solution, you know, in step 2. And for me, you know, there is something to that come to believe, because, you know, in the first, I don't know, maybe week or so, and maybe some of you remember, I came to meetings drunk. I came to in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a good place to come to, I'll tell you. But, you know, then in step 3, I get to decide, do I want to live in that problem, or do I want to live in the solution? You know, and the way I get to do that every day is by turning my will and my life over to a care of God, of my understanding. And I do that, I get to do that all day long. You know, when I get up in the morning, how I react, how I am with my husband. You know, first off, you know, I get to make him coffee or breakfast, or am I going to be selfish and, ooh, I don't got time to make you any coffee or breakfast. You know, I mean, we get to decide. It's not the one big thing we do that makes the decision of doing God's will, because God don't need us to do service this way. He needs it this way, you know, and he comes through us that way. And it's the small things. It's not like when everybody's watching that, you know, I'm doing God's will, and I'm all step three in it, all over the place, you know. It's, it's when I'm doing God's will when I don't want to do it, you know, when nobody's looking, and when I think, well, you don't deserve a cup of coffee this morning. There's not too many mornings he doesn't get a cup of coffee, I don't think. But anyway, I don't even know why I went there. I wasn't even going there. Then all of a sudden I started talking about how I started my day. Maybe it's time for me to stop talking. You know, to make a long story short, I came into the program. I keep it very simple. And my sponsor helps me do that. And I trust God, clean house, work with others. I read the big book. I work the steps. I work them from 1 to 12. And I rework them and I work them and work them again. I've done so many fear inventories and four-step inventories, and, you know, till my sponsor one time said, no more four steps. You need to learn how to walk through this. And, cause sometimes you'll be somewhere where you can't get to a meeting, or you don't have time to write it out. What are you gonna do? And how are you gonna react? And how are you gonna handle it? And, okay, so then I had to shorten the process, you know, but then I got to learn through going to step study meetings. Man, there's like, 6 or 7 different inventories. The quick spot check inventory, you know, the retreat kind where you go away for a women's retreat or something, that's coming up. Or, you know, whether you do the annual house cleaning or, you know, a written 10 step, there's lots of different kinds of inventories. And, you know, I got to learn that in here. And all of that helped me walk through life without picking up a drink. You know, and that was a miracle to me. I can remember when I first went to court, and, you know, I was so fearful of, you know, going into the courtroom and my DWI, and they're going to get up there. And one thing, if you're in a blackout and you get a DWI, don't worry about it, because everybody in the world is going to read to you what you were like and what you did and what happened. And, you know, if you can't remember, so you can tell the insurance company, you know, the policeman will certainly help you out. And so I thought, okay, we're going to go in here, and I got to listen to all, you know what it was. I had to look at my part in it, you know, and I never wanted to look at my part in it. I always wanted somebody to make it go away, make it better, get an attorney, do whatever, you know, let the attorney go to court. I don't even want to show up, or, you know, all of that insanity. But here I am, my husband says, you made the mess, you clean it up. And so that was the first. He had gotten into the program. That's what happened. Things changed. And I said, ooh, I better get into some AA, because he's going to get one of them little AA honeys. I ain't even going to have a husband. I used to think I'd be saying, like, I'm going to an AA meeting, and, you know, 3 days later I come home, you know, and I'm thinking, what are they thinking? It was a bad meeting? You know, I don't know. But when I did relapse, I'll tell you one thing. His home group told him, you know, that they would love him through it, and they did. They held him up through all of that, however long I was out there the last time, and they told him, let her go, you know, and what happened was, you guys loved my husband when I didn't know how. And that's another thing I have to be grateful for. Because when I didn't have the capacity to be honest or to love or to have a lot of the other gifts that we receive in this program, you know, we do that for each other. We take care of families and we take care of spouses and we go out on 12-step calls and we go to hospitals and, you know, we get to work with the whole family, and what a miracle that got to happen in my life, because I get the opportunity to pass that on too. And, you know, I'll forget this one story with talking about a 12-step call, and that's one thing that just kind of cinched me into, just letting God run my whole show, because I always used to judge, and I would think, and I would say, oh, you know, like me and my girlfriend came in at the same time. I looked at her, I said, oh, she ain't gonna make it. Same time she's looking at me, she ain't gonna make it with all that history, you know, and, actually we're both still sober. And, we joke about that sometimes, but me and my sponsor went on a 12-step call, and this is someone I had sponsored and gone on a couple other 12-step calls with her previously, for her, and this time before I was like all excited, and I was, you know, just moved, and I had compassion, and for some reason this time I was like, I don't want to go. And when I went there, you know, I was just looking at the obvious. I was like, No, it was, you know what it's like when we drink for a week and our house is all shut up and it's dirty and messy, and I was like going in the door, whew, you know, and then we start washing dishes. My sponsor starts washing dishes because, you know, I don't want to, so I'm picking the trash, and instead of picking it downstairs, I'm putting it on her balcony, you know, and I'm like, you know, really going through the motions. And then, you know, I start calling Clithero to see if there's a bed, and calling the hospital and the paramedic. Do you see what I can line up to help get her to where she needs to be to get the help she needs to detox? And, you know, I'm realizing that I'm thinking, you know, this, I think we're wasting our time and blah, blah, blah. So then I go into the room. And she's laying on the bed, and I sit down on the edge of the bed, you know, and there's like bucket of puke and garbage and bottles all over the place. And, you know, I'm just like, don't even want to sit on the bed. And so then I sit down and I look at her, and, you know, she's crying. And all of a sudden God convicts my heart. And you know what I see when I look at her? I see me. And I see all the people that have sat on that edge of the bed over the last 30 years and took care of me or helped me or, you know, did what I was supposed to be doing there. And all that was loving her, you know, loving her until she could love herself. And that's what, you know, the gift of sobriety gives me, because that was like a mirror. But at the same time, it was also a way that I could see. You know, like Dr. Bob says it best when he says we carry the message for the, you know, four reasons. One, because it's a sense of duty. Two, because it's a pleasure. And three, because we're paying back. You know, he says the man that carried the message to him, but for the numerous women that have carried the message to me, it's a way of paying back. And the fourth reason is, you know, nothing ensures impunity against that next drink than working with others. And, you know, for me, I had SR-22 for a lot of years, and that didn't keep me sober. You know, this insurance works. I mean, working with another alcoholic will work where everything else will fail. And, you know, I came in and out of here, in and out of here, in and out of here, you know, and nothing changed. And, you know, my first son was born an addict, and when my last son died, I was drunk. You know, and what had changed in the span of 18, 19 years? You know, nothing. My addiction was the only thing that had changed. I hadn't changed at all. And you know what? The miracle today is that I have had that spiritual awakening. The miracle today is my life is completely changed. Somewhere between 1 and 12, God showed up large and in charge of my life. You know, somewhere between 1 and 12, you know, the miracle of recovery happened. I had that personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. And I only get that, you know, I have a daily reprieve, you know, contingent on my spiritual condition. So, you know, I have a friend and she says, what kind of condition is your condition in today, you know? Used to be an old song. But, you know, today I just want to say, if you're new, keep coming back. And, you know, that's one thing I heard, and I did. I kept coming back, although people probably were, oh, my God, the women would scatter. Ooh, she might ask me to smother her. No. But, no. So now today when I go to a meeting and somebody's wet there and they're, you know, drunk and they're loud, obnoxious, and, you know, nobody wants to sponsor, I'm like, they're mine. That's my way of paying back, you know, because I get to, I just get to do what Dr. Bob suggests. And what he said simply at the very end, I guess, and I read this somewhere, that he said, let's keep this thing simple. Let's don't louse it up. You know, so every day I just pray that God keeps me right size, help me keep it simple, and help me to walk in his light, his way of life, you know, because when and I don't know the... Well, this inspired me to learn that 11-step prayer, and I still got it hanging up somewhere, but I don't, on my computer now. I had it on my mirror at home. I still didn't get it, you know. But the very last line in there where it says it's in the dying that we get to awaken to eternal life. You know, and today I'm alive. I have a desire to live, and it's in the dying that I get to live. And so, you know, it's that dying to self daily. It's that third step, you know, choosing, you know, whose will? God's will, my will, you know, and you can do that. You know, if you're new here today, you can choose to live, and you never, you never have to drink again. And I will guarantee somewhere between working steps 1 and 12 that God will show up in your life, a God of your understanding. And if you don't have one today, you could use the AA group at first. You know, that's, or just, you can do it. Just be, if you have the willingness, that God will show up large and in charge of your life. Trust me, it works. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.